Welcome to MacGuffin. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We've talked about a wide variety of topics most recently. The last three we've done have been Casablanca, Furious 7, and A Most Violent Year, all of which are good movies for pretty different reasons. So yeah, you can check those out on themacguffinmen.com. Also follow us on Twitter, at themacguffinmen, no underscore or anything like that. And yeah, you can keep up with all of our latest exploits, which are almost exclusively new podcasts. Anyway, yeah, we'll just we'll get right to it. All right.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yeah.
What are we talking about here today?
Clueless.
Yes. Exactly. The
1995.
Yeah. The 20-year anniversary of Clueless.
Could you believe it?
I can, because, I mean, it's 20 years after 1995. So, yes. The short answer is yes, I can believe it.
Oh, man. Does it seem like 20 years ago you saw this in theaters?
No, it seems like 5 years ago I saw this on my friend's couch. That's what it seems like to me.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You didn't have any Tony Curtis movies nearby to watch?
No, I didn't have any copies of Spartacus around. I saw that one even more recently, actually, so... That's up for its like 60th anniversary or whatever, but it's like 2 month anniversary for me. It's not a great film. You could skip it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let's talk about great films then. Oh, so sure. Clueless came out in 1995.
Yep. Written and directed by Amy Heckerling.
Yeah. Most famously of Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Correct. The director of that. Yeah.
Yes. And she wrote and directed this movie. Mm-hmm. I guess we should say loosely based on Jane Austen's Emma.
Correct.
Yep. How do you like this movie?
I'd give it two very enthusiastic thumbs up. Fine Hollywood holiday fun.
It certainly was good holiday fun.
No, I'm not as crazy about this movie as some people. I actually think the first 20 minutes is kind of a slog, but pretty much once Ty shows up, I think this movie's pretty fucking great. Like, it's just, it's a good time.
Yeah. You are a unabashed fan of teen movies.
Correct. No abashes here.
No abash necessary. Yeah, exactly. Does does this work for you the way that teen movies normally do, or is there something different about this one? Or
There is something different about this movie that I found really interesting, that I did not recall from first seeing it. There is no character that grounds this movie. say we're looking at Mean Girls, right? Katie's the lead. We get her voiceover. She's a seemingly normal person in this crazy world, right? And we learn lessons through the movie through her eyes. And in this movie, the lead is obviously Cher, who's doing the voiceover and all that. But she's clearly not meant to be seen as like a normal human being. And, you know, you would think for a second, maybe when Ty shows up, that maybe she's the character that's going to be this person that's going to ground the movie. And there just never really is that character. And I found that really fascinating. It's just this insane world with all of these insane people in it. And nobody is really human. And I found that really interesting, because always in teen movies, you get somebody that is supposed to be some semblance of a normal human being. And that, I think, is totally absent from this movie. And I found that fascinating.
We get hinted towards that pretty quickly. It's as quick as Cher is saying how she's a normal teenager and her life is just like every other girl. And while she's describing this, she's matching her outfits with computer technology, which is crazy now, but insane in 1995. Yeah. Like, it gets set up, like, we kind of get tipped to that very early on, that we have an extremely unreliable narrator, mm-hmm. Intent on deceiving us, but who is maybe deceiving herself or just to borrow the title of the movie, just kind of clueless. We're quickly pointed out that we are not going to relate to this character very quickly. And the way that she describes things is not going to be the way that we really feel about them at all.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
Yeah, we don't have that character. What's so crazy about Ty?
Ty is just still seems like there's just some element of just character to her. Maybe it's just in the accent or something, but she, or the fact that, you know, she goes through all of these different sort of character types over the course of the movie. She comes in as a stoner, and she just, she changes pretty drastically, probably three different times in this movie, you know? And she's always just kind of being tugged along, and her end point is never really something that's meant to the movie wants to focus on at all. So if she is a normal person, then the movie doesn't care about her, which I think further kind of proves my point. if in a more complicated way, you know?
Yeah, she comes out swinging though, Brittany Murphy, in this one. Like her first scene when she shows up in the PE class and, holy shit, you guys got coke here? Like, very, very quickly, she makes me laugh.
No, she's a good time.
Yeah,
this
I think I've seen this movie a few times. This is the one where I definitely thought about Mean Girls the most.
Mean Girls.
There's a lot of comparisons.
Yeah, Mean Girls is 50% Clueless, 50% Heathers, more or less. Like, Mean Girls was not, is a wonderful, perfect film, not overly original, you know, like all good teen movies, it is a twist on teen movies that have come before it.
Right. Yeah. I guess I kind of was aware of Clueless when watching Mean Girls, you know, the last few times that I had seen it, and never really thought about the two of them together. And, you know, they are different movies, but I mean, we have the new girl show up and kind of this time fake redhead show up.
Yeah.
And, you know, throw off the whole power balance. And this movie certainly isn't as much about Cher wanting to maintain her power at the top. I mean, she's definitely, all of Clueless is, you know, that half of Mean Girls from the plastics angle.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
The plastics aren't as horrible people in Clueless.
Yeah, Cher is never actively malicious in this film, I don't think.
No, I don't know. There's just so many things about this movie and about Cher's character that I think are tough to negotiate. And, like, I think you can make... it's a really interesting piece of media that totally allows you to argue that it's commercial and about sexualizing teenagers and about materialism and all these kinds of things. And then you can make the argument that the movie's really in on that kind of thing. And it's making jokes from the inside. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, I agree entirely. I feel like there's something about this movie. I just feel like if somebody was to ask me, obviously today, because I've been thinking about Clueless all day, but I feel like even a year from now, if somebody was to ask me to describe the 1990s in 97 minutes, I would just give them a copy of Clueless. I feel like it captures so many, like, it really captures so many broad elements of the 1990s and just throws them all together in a way that's so entertaining. And I don't know, really as a document of history, it's really fascinating, you know? I don't know, this is like, as somebody that was experiencing culture in the 90s, but was at the end of the 90s, not even 14, this really feels like everything that I experienced for 10 years, like, mashed together, you know?
Yeah, and it's so interesting because it doesn't reflect our life at all.
No, like, not at all.
Being super rich females in Beverly Hills. But I know exactly what you mean, like, culture-wise, this does it really quickly. And I thought a small thing I definitely forgot about this movie is it seems really aware of that even then.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It starts off being the most 90s anything could be, you know, with the color scheme and the intro, and then... I don't even know what you call that effect, but we'll call it the Noxema commercial effect for the purposes of this podcast.
Yeah.
Like, it's the weird zooms on seemingly nothing and that, like, I don't know, the, like, dragging visuals. I don't know what it is, but, like, it's so interesting to me that in the first like minute of this movie, they're like, this is so crazy, Nine. Mm-hmm. To it, it's not just every 90s stereotype thrown in and nothing else. Like, there is something very timeless and interesting about this movie, which is why I think it got its cult status and why people, I think, could still watch this movie for the first time today and find it an entertaining movie.
Yeah, I would agree.
But I love how quickly they do that visually. Like, they point out everything. They just dump all of it on you so quickly and then are like, okay, this is where we are. This is what we're doing. We're not going to go 100% with it. But yeah, this is going to be pretty fucking 90s. So here we go.
Yeah, and even just the Cher versus Josh sort of thing. Like, those are kind of the two most prevalent ways to be a youth in the 90s. Somebody that was kind of like into... you know, we never see Cher really talk about boy bands all that much, but somebody that's into the mass pop, the colorful lifestyle that boy bands kind of existed within, and the Spice Girls and all that. And then you've got Josh, the Nirvana-bee, if you will, like that sort of slacker, wannabe cerebral guy of the grunge movement, or as Dion describes it, he's in his post-adolescent idealistic phase. And I think that really kind of describes two of, if not the most prevalent ways to approach the 1990s as a youth, two of the more prevalent ways for sure.
Oh yeah, I would think so. I love all the kind of signifiers that we get for Josh, Paul Rudd's character being, you know, that character, that kind of grunge environmentalist, you know, anti-consumer, pro-environment kind of guy.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, his model in University Radio. his Nietzsche book with the giant text say Friedrich Nietzsche on it. Just a picture on the front cover. I love that. Undefined
goatee
Nietzsche.
That seems to last 8 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. He shaves before he drives into the mall. Or goes to the mall. I also really love the name Travis Birkenstock. Birkenstock is like the most 1990s name of all time. I love it so much. Like, it's the best. Yeah,
it's pretty impressive. Yeah. And speaking of how modern this movie is, getting Marky Mark to plant a celebrity tree is still a remarkably good joke to me.
Like, that would still be funny now, you know, like even if there was a movie where somebody's talking about Mark Wahlberg planting a celebrity tree like in 2015, that would make me laugh. And Marky Mark is just even funnier. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Josh is interesting, though, because I mean, I guess if everyone's in. Like, as I said, you can make the argument about consumerism and all these kinds of things in this movie. But I guess Josh would be the one, like, as much as we're making fun of him, I think, like, I mean, as much as I feel like the movie's making fun of him, the realization at the end is that he's kind of right, no? Like, Cher takes her powers of manipulation and, you know, her ability to make things her way and decides instead of, you know, just matchmaking or getting her own boys or you know, getting more clothes and things like that, she wants to help other people. And, you know, some of the comedy comes from her donating caviar and her donating, you know, skiing equipment and things like that. But I think we're supposed to be left with the idea that she's become a better person, right?
I don't know. I don't know that we're supposed to think that she's necessarily become a better person. I think she's just made a very key realization. And I think, you know, there's a throughout this movie, we see Cher as, you know, a fixer, somebody that sees herself as perfect and sees it as her job to make the world around her a better place, even though everything she does is, to quote Josh, at least 90% selfish, you know, like she's yeah, hooking getting these teachers together because she wants her report card, her average to be higher. And, you know, throughout the movie, people get referred to as clueless. Ty gets referred to as clueless and becomes Cher's new project because Cher views herself as not clueless. And even Josh calls Cher clueless at one point as Josh is making a sandwich and then walking away from everything he used to make the sandwich. You know, he's totally clueless as to the things he actually leaves in his wake, even though he thinks he's ahead of the game. And I think with that all by myself montage and all those shots of Josh as she's sort of coming to this realization, is that she's kind of figuring out that as much as she tries to exert control over others, she should just be trying to figure herself out. And this goes back to what I was saying about how there's no real grounding to this movie. There's no character that we can really relate to, in that Cher is basically figuring out that the world is inherently uncontrollable and all you can do is try to find your own slice of happiness in this like mad, mad world. You know, like that's what I think the ending of Clueless is. And I think it's weirdly kind of like half dark and really fascinating and very individualistic in a way that I feel like is in tune with the rest of the film. And I think it's the cherry on top of a very bizarre satirical sundae. You know? So that's what I look at when I think of Cher.
I don't know. I guess I... Yeah, well, it is. I mean, I should point out kind of structurally, this movie is also really all over the place. Like, there really isn't a through line of kind of narrative progress throughout this movie.
No, not at all.
It's kind of one of those like lifestyle movies are like main character navigates the crazy world of blah, blah, blah. And so you can throw like a bunch of different conflicts in the way and there's not really an overarching one. Mm-hmm. Because yeah, I mean, it's at first it's her report card, as you said, and then it's you know, saving Ty, you know, her next project, as she literally calls her. Mm-hmm. Then it's pursuing Christian, and then it's a makeover of her soul and getting Josh or whatever. So yeah, it really is like all over the place. Like, to say in 30 minutes into this movie what you think is going to happen by the end, it really happens in the next 10 minutes and then something all new starts again. I get left with the idea that she's been growing towards Josh and kind of sees the value in it. And I know what you mean by like, she can't control everything. She can't fix everybody. And she kind of needs to work on herself, but yeah, I don't know how far that extends. I think she kind of lets Ty be her own person and, you know, spend time with Travis instead of Elton or whoever Cher mm-hmm. thinks is the best match for her, for Ty at the time. But I do get the sense that there is some growth. And I think that her realization of her feelings towards Josh, it achieves something that I really like. And it doesn't make this movie all about finding that boy or getting that boy or kind of validating your personality through getting a particular guy to say that they love you or date you or care about you or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's kind of just her realization that she's been looking for the wrong things in people. And it's not that she finally captured this person. It's that she, is thinking about more than who's the most popular guy and which guy's dad can get you the most concert tickets and things like that.
Yeah.
And I think that goes hand in hand with the idea that she can't control everything. Like, I just think that she lets people be who they are and kind of finds out what she wants for herself. And you know, I think she's genuine about, wanting to, you know, say, help with the Pismo Beach disaster or something. Like, I think the way she works on Ty and the way that she plays matchmaker for her teachers is so much about what she's going to be able to gain from it. But mm-hmm. I think by the end of the movie, I think that there are some genuinely selfless things. And I think that there is a bit of growth.
There's certainly a bit of growth. I don't know that Cher is necessarily a better person at the end of the movie than she is at the beginning. Yeah. And if she is, then I think it's a slight difference is my feeling on it. Yeah. I also don't think Josh really goes ahead and becomes an environmental lawyer. I kind of get the feeling that he just kind of continues on as Cher's father does, you know, like he kind of he eventually comes to a similar realization that Cher comes to, and realizes that the best he can do in life is kind of find what will make him happy. And as Dan Hedaya argues, environmental law is a way, quick way to hate your life. And his life as a litigator is at least financially lucrative, even though from the outside looking in, it does not look like an enjoyable life. You know?
Yeah, I thought even the character of the dad isn't as cookie cutter as a lot of teen movies would make the lawyer father. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
He, you know, clearly works hard at his job and things like that. But he seems to have genuine concern for Cher. I think that you divorce parents. You divorce wives. You don't divorce children is like one of the sweetest lines in this whole movie.
Yeah,
granted.
Yeah,
emotionally, I don't get a ton from this movie. I really like this movie, but it's not for the emotional things it does for me. But I thought that was like an oddly sweet thing. And I think he's like very protective and intelligent. And, you know, you can argue his reaction to Cher getting her grades changed might not be what they teach you in a lot of parenting techniques. But, you know, I think his heart's generally in the right place. And I think this movie... does a lot of things like that where it just avoids a ton of cliches about how to round out that character. And this happens with a lot of characters. And I think that while it does play into so many stereotypes and cliches, like I think the way that it does break from certain teen movie conventions and from gender and genre conventions, I think is what makes this movie the most interesting.
Yeah. Well, and playing into what you said about the father-daughter relationship, this movie even has that its own take on the sort of the John Hughes dad conversation that is probably most famous in Pretty in Pink with Harry Dean Stockton. And it starts with him saying, tell me a problem and we'll figure out how to argue it. And it ends up being turning into some sort of mild fatherly advice. I don't quite remember the quotes at the end of the scene, but it ends up being a conversation between people as opposed to these two characters. I also really like Dan Hedaya in this movie. I think he's super funny. I think the only way he could have been better is if he was Dennis Farina, but we can't be picky with this movie, I suppose. But yeah, I agree. He is more of a character than a lot of his lines will, like him yelling at Ty to get out of his chair, which I think is incredibly funny. That's sort of a more caricature moment for his character than he actually is throughout the movie. You know, he is much more of a father than, you know, most 90s movie lawyers that you see. You know, the 90s was not a really good time for lawyers in cinema. You know, they weren't portrayed well typically.
Grisham tried his best, but. I don't think, you know, don't even, I mean, I like Dennis Farina a lot too, but we get a pretty good cast out of this movie.
This cast is amazing. One other thing that is amazing about this cast, so many of these people have just not aged since 1995. It's like Paul Rudd was born as a 30-year-old man and he's just gotten to stay 30 his whole life. Like, he doesn't look any different today. It's crazy. And same with Breckenmeyer. Stacey Dash still looks exactly the same. Donald Faison still looks exactly the same. Like, it's crazy how nobody in this cast seems to have aged. It's very bizarre.
Does Stacey Dash make your list of good voices?
I don't know. I haven't thought about it, but she certainly doesn't have a bad voice.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if it doesn't stand out to you, then I won't put it on the list. What else is kind of particularly 90s about this movie for you? Other than Beavis and Butthead and Ren and Stimpy and
the new Christian
Looking
Slater
for Meaning in a Pauly Shore movie.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I had somebody say so. I was talking to somebody yesterday that said something vaguely positive about Pauly Shore. I was like, "Don't do this around me, please. Don't. I will not let this happen." there's like, I don't know. It's a lot of the visual stuff, like just the color schemes that we've talked about. Particularly the way men's fashion is portrayed in this film is exceedingly 90s. The quick all the young dudes segment.
Pastels.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. The quick all the young dudes segment where it's just Cher talking about how guys dress And how is she supposed to be attracted to people wearing pants this baggy, just hanging down off their ass and stuff like that? It's just four guys walking, all looking like the goofiest people in the world. And anytime Murray is shown with his pants basically falling off, and he's wearing a belt, but it's even unbuckled, I found that like a really nice visual gag throughout the movie. But yeah, the other big one I think is just Christian and his whole Mighty Mighty Boss Tones sort of thing. That's something that I always think about the 90s that was so bizarre and seems to be kind of forgotten about, and makes me so happy that it is in this movie, because ska and all those things that were a part of the 90s but have kind of been forgotten as a part of the 90s, just a lot of good jokes to be had on that part of culture. Yeah, all of which can be found within Clueless.
Yeah, exactly. But oh man, the ska thing, like, you can without knowing the year, you could pin this down to like the 6 months this was filmed in the 90s, just from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones being the coolest thing they could put in this movie.
Yeah, for sure.
And I don't know,
this movie's clearly like filmed in that 6 week period where Zoot Suit Riot is on the Billboard charts, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I just, like, talking about this as a document of the 90s, and, you know, I don't even think we've mentioned how big this movie was. Like, it really did make a big splash, and it kind of came out of nowhere. It was a sleeper hit, like a TV series, book series, Barbie dolls, like a lot of merchandise and stuff came out of this, and just some kind of harder to quantify things like fashion and language that this movie put forward. I think
I was walking by,
there's a ton of stuff in here, and I think
I was walking by a mailbox today, and somebody had written "as if!" exclamation mark on this mailbox. And this is 2015. This is 20 years after this movie came out. And I just couldn't believe it. It was crazy. It was just written on there in whiteout. Clueless is still very much a part of day-to-day life, even if it's just plastered over mailboxes. But sorry, continue.
No, it's a good point. Like, I kind of want to talk about this versus Mean Girls a little bit, but I think that this movie, it did really change language and fashion than most movies, including Mean Girls. But like, just to think of this as you know, like a time capsule of the 90s as a whole generation, I think it serves it so well that like this movie was dated for 18 months after it came out by the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones. I think that there's something really, really charming about that. Like, as I said, I think this movie still holds up, and it's really modern in a bunch of ways, and I think could be watched by someone you know, born in the year 2000, and you know, that would put them at 15, which is the age Cher is in this movie, which is something I constantly forget because of what's going on in this movie and how she acts. But I really enjoy that fact so much, that like it was really dated really quickly, but it's also just timeless forever. And you know, maybe that's an overstatement, but I think like it's it has this kind of very immediate and kind of everlasting appeal to it that it's amazing to me that, as I said at the beginning, like it's so painfully 90s, and you know, it does relent after that Noxzema commercial sequence, but it certainly never goes away. And yeah, the one to get the Boss Tones, and it's like, yeah, this is early 1995 in California. Like, it's you about the time. I love just the way that those two timelines function in this movie.
Agreed. Yeah.
Do we need to talk more about Christian?
I get a big kick out of him, and so many of his lines, like the heavy clam bake might be one of my favorite lines in this movie. Like, there's just something so funny about that to me. But yeah, I don't know. I just like that type of character. And I like all of the jokes that are related to him. And yeah, I'm a big fan of Christian in this movie. I get a big kick out of all that shit.
Yeah, and I mean, I love all the 50s stuff for reasons I've probably described before, but it's so out of place, and he's so committed to it. I think the actor is not very good. Like, I think he does not have the charisma that this role requires at all, and I don't know, maybe because this movie buys good favor for me in other places, I feel that that still works. Like, he's so bad at being irritating that that's irritating. And I don't know, it works for me for some reason.
I would agree. I think I feel like, yeah, you're correct. I don't think that actor is particularly good. I think it's further proven by the fact that he's not in a lot of things afterwards. Despite, I think, being a very memorable part of this movie, it's more memorable for the writing than it is for his performance. Although I will say the way he walks into Cher's house on the date is incredibly funny. But that is for such a well cast and well performed movie, he is one of the weak points. And I also think Alicia Silverstone is. I feel like she's the weak point of this movie. I think she's fine, but this movie, I think, would be so much better for me if she was better in it. And I think that's part of the reason why the first 20 minutes is kind of the most difficult to get through, because it's the most, even though the whole movie is incredibly Cher-centered or centric, the first 20 minutes is where it really revolves around the Cher introduction. And I just don't think she's that great in this movie. And, you know, it's still a very good movie, despite my lack of feelings for Alicia Silverstone's performance. But, I don't know. I can't even imagine how positively I would think about this movie if I enjoyed the actress that was playing Cher.
Yeah, I'm not one to defend Alicia Silverstone a lot, but I think she's good in this. And I think it's a really, really hard role to play, because I think it's tough, because it's one of the many movies, one of the many ways that this movie kind of wants you to have it both ways. Like, she is so self-absorbed and materialistic and naive and childish in all these ways, but I still think we're supposed to like her in a way. Mm-hmm. And I do. I don't know what it is. Again, I'm not nuts about Alicia Silverstone at all. I think this is just the perfect role for her. And I mean, if we're going to talk about a career is not going perfectly after Clueless, we could talk about her some more. But
what, you didn't like Excess Baggage?
No, I did not.
That's the only title I could come up with. Sorry, continue. Blast from the Past, she's in that, right?
No, I just... Yeah, she is. And Brendan Fraser.
The Brendan Fraser.
I just mean, like, I think that she came out of this movie with so much heat. And I heard someone describe her, and if some people are going to get upset about this, but like having a kind of Marilyn Monroe kind of thing where she's so much of the American ideal that you want to hate her, but something about her just prevents you from doing so. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's true of Alicia Silverstone in any other part of her career except Clueless. But I think it does apply for that one. And I think it's tough to have those movies, like to have a movie that's in on the joke and have a character that is outside of the joke. I think that is hard to deal with. And I think she negotiates a tough role. Did you see that Paul Rudd wanted to play Murray or Christian more than Josh?
No. Both of those are great.
Oh, I would love both of those so much.
Yeah. That's really funny.
Yeah, I like that. You always try to work a Reagan or Clinton idea into anything 80s or 90s. You got anything on this one?
Well, I mean, it's kind of what I talked about with Cher being the overpaid, underworked, sort of overly comfortable American. That's kind of the thing that comes out of the Clinton administration, right? Like, he kind of, all things considered, had a pretty easy presidency, compared to the presidents that surrounded him. That's kind of the thing that I think this movie further represents about the 1990s, is that it wasn't really a particularly tumultuous decade, certainly the mid-90s. That's another way it is kind of a time capsule, even though nothing even close to the presidency is mentioned in this film, you know?
Yeah, no, we get like Josh and Cher going back between Beavis and Butthead and CNN. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he watches CNN a few times and says, in some parts of the world, it's considered cool to know what's going on, or whatever that line is. Mm-hmm. It really just kind of brushes by anything like that. But no, I think, I mean, I kind of had the same take on it when I thought about it through that lens. It's like, the economy is booming. We're not constantly at war. Let's just embrace some materialism and self-absorption. And that's what Clueless is.
Yeah. And
it's that... done in an interesting way. And like, there is kind of that cynicism that goes throughout this movie. It's certainly not what we see post 9/11. It's kind of this like, you know, the Nirvana kind of getting out of the conformities of the 80s. Some people, you know, as you said, like there's kind of that split. Some people take the share out and kind of live in this place of bounty and, you know, finer things in life and just having a good time and worrying about boys and clothes. And then you have the Josh who, you know, say what you want about, maybe is a bit self-absorbed. Maybe he kind of likes lording things over Cher too, but at least is on the surface into issues and into, you know, the concerns of other people. And yeah, it's not the best example because he's also living in Beverly Hills. And as you said, like leaving food out for fucking someone else to deal with and walking away while he judges other people for being inconsiderate and clueless. But yeah, like even on the surface, those were kind of the two ways to take it. And I think this movie has that cynicism that I think people in Josh's group, the tree people and other groups, I assume he runs with, you know, would have with them. And there's kind of the sarcasm about, you know, feminist issues and consumer issues and things like that, or capitalist issues and things like that. That is throughout this movie. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that's all very, you know, symptomatic of the decade as well, as you said.
Yeah, for sure. And just to tie that together with what we were talking about a little bit earlier, with boy bands and stuff, that's kind of what allowed boy bands to become such a big thing, or this loud, like brightly colored pop music to exist. All of these boy bands, Spice Girls, all this shit comes out of the fact that people are comfortable enough to just sort of accept this type of just happiness. And the grunge movement worked in the direct opposite way. And it was just always about, and the slacker sort of thing was all about just, all of these things are so bright and loud, we're going to be so relaxed and do nothing. Like, we're going to be actively doing nothing. And even a combination of those two things ends up creating this sort of like late 90s thing where just before 9/11, we get all these cultural tricksters popping up that are just kind of fighting back against the overly colorful boy bands. And that's when you get Jackass and Eminem that become a big part of culture. And yeah, I think that Clueless kind of... it very much fits in with both sides of that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Eminem taught Brittany Murphy how to give the middle finger and everything came full circle.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is becoming a common question on here. How did you feel about this movie's approach to drug and alcohol use?
It seemed pretty, I was fine with it. I mean, certainly our lead stoner character Travis Birkenstock, the great Travis Birkenstock, gives up his
38 tardies.
Oh fuck, his speech is so good.
Yeah, it is.
He gives up his wayward stonerdom, I suppose. So yeah, I guess it doesn't really demonize it, but it certainly isn't. I don't know. It's not a pro drugs movie by any means.
No, I thought this movie had I don't want to say healthy because they're 15.
yeah.
Because I honestly always forget that they're 15. Like, I always just assume they're in grade 12 or if they had OAC then there. And I think I'd be a lot more comfortable with a lot of things in this movie if that were the case, mm-hmm. But it's not, unfortunately. I just mean, you know, even Cher says like it's okay to get laced at a party and, you know, smoke a joint then, but being high all the time is just a whole other thing. And like, this movie's opinion of sex seems to be like, don't slut shame someone because they have had sex, mm-hmm. but, you know, find someone you like and wait. And yeah, and I think like even with the, you know, Travis's drug quitting and the however many step program he joins. It doesn't fundamentally change who he is. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't like he's a totally different person. He's just kind of more focused. And the skateboarding thing, which is totally part of the slacker identity, you know, he doesn't throw out his skateboard with those bongs and stuff. He just kind of focuses on what he values and, you know, gets away from drugs and focuses more on the other things in his life. And I don't see a lot of the, like, you know, oh, you can smoke weed on the weekends at a party, but don't get high at school kind of thing. And I don't know, maybe for the mid-90s, that's different, or?
Yeah, I think you're actually probably right. That's probably pretty progressive, all things considered.
Yeah, and even, like, because some people were surprised by this movie's PG-13 rating, and I could totally see what parts they would be talking about. And even the swearing and stuff, there is some very, you know, rude language in this movie at times, but it's not out of anger and hate. It's like often out of frustration, or, you know, Ty saying she's being the tart in this situation. it's really not hateful, not violent, angry language. And the messages on drug use are like pretty okay and soft to me. Like, just don't get high all the time. Obviously you can drink, but don't do it all the time, and don't drive and things like that. I didn't know if that was something that you can't do anymore, or it was really odd for that time, or kind of what you thought of that.
I think it's, you know, now that you've pointed it out, I definitely do think it is kind of, it's certainly odd in that way. Like, there's not a lot of movies that I feel like portray drugs and alcohol that way. I still think it could very much exist in a movie today. Like, had the Duff featured a party scene, I think you could have very seen discussions of drugs along the lines of Clueless, and nobody would have batted an eye. But yeah, I think it's just something that, as long as your teen movie isn't focused too much on drugs, you can kind of say whatever about whatever you like about drugs, basically. And drugs are very much not,
yeah,
they're just something that exists in high school in this movie. They're not the focus of this movie.
Yeah, and even when they get high, it doesn't seem to change too much, you know? Like, it's, you know, they giggle a bit and they laugh, but it's nothing too crazy. I don't know, I thought this kind of had a pretty realistic display of marijuana use, all things considered.
I agree.
Okay. So do you want to talk any more about the music other than Benny Bostones? Or do you think that's all that's worth mentioning?
That there's 4,000 songs in this movie.
Yeah.
That's about it. That's pretty much all I've got music wise. Like, there's some jams and some poor choices, but, you know, overall it works.
Where does Rollin' with the Homies fall?
Oh, I just love those. I love both times Brittany Murphy sings Rollin' with the Homies. I love it so much, and she's so funny in both of those scenes.
She's the best.
Not necessarily the best to me, but she's very great in those moments. And those are some of the highlights of the movie to me. But yeah, I'm not going to say Coolio is the rapper I want everybody to remember from the 90s. But you know, that song at least provided me with some entertainment.
Okay, I'll allow that. Yeah. Most of this is with Josh, but I really do... I really like the use of diegetic music, like a lot of the music that, like, you know, as you said, the maudlin sounds of the university radio station when he shows up, and when he's driving his berated girlfriend home after picking up Cher from. I really like that. That idea makes sense to me. Like, the people you're with is going to depend on going to change the music you hear and things like that. And I thought, it could have been used a bit more as some other people, because it was only really Josh that we got that with for the most part. But I thought that was nice. I thought that was something that, like, really rang true. And maybe, I don't know, maybe I just recognized more of those songs than some of the other ones. Read into that what you want.
Yeah, yeah.
But I thought that was good.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And I think one moment in the movie that kind of points to what you were talking about is early on in the movie, what's his name? Elton. is talking about how he left his cranberry CD out in the quad, and he has to go get it before, which is great because you can see him going through his CDs during Cher's speech about the Haitians. He's going through his CDs, and then he says he has to go to the quad to get his cranberry CD. And then I think when he's driving Cher home after the Californian scene, when he's driving her home, I think they're listening to the Cranberries, which I found very humorous.
That's what it sounded like to me.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, then I am probably right. I couldn't get a good listen, and I also am just not well-versed on the Cranberries. I'm not a real zombie head or whatever Cranberries fans are called, but I thought that was a nice touch and really plays into what you were discussing. And the scene that Christian kind of dominates is the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones scene, which, again, further proves the point.
So two things. I think they're called Fanberries.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Yep.
And can I go get my cranberry CD from the cafeteria better than my foot hurts? Can I go to the nurse? Delivered with 100% confidence all the time.
I think there's something about jokes about the quad that I just have always found funny. So I think that one gets the upper hand. And I do, again, despite not being a fanberry, I do like cranberry jokes. So it's just sort of a combination of things, you know. Just gives it the upper hand.
Yeah. were you familiar with the term cake boy before this movie? As a big
no, that one jumped out to me too. I was not familiar with the term, but thanks to Donald Faison for making me aware, I suppose. It was like, because there's Cake Eater in the Mighty Ducks, which is a thing that for rich people that I've never heard outside of the Mighty Ducks, and maybe just pejoratives involving cake were a thing in the 90s.
You know? I guess.
The 90s were not a decade for people to eat cake happily, you know? Unless you want to get hated on.
Oh, did you like Donald Faison's discussion of the word woman?
Oh my God. Absolutely.
It's becoming more and more valid all the time.
Pretty much everything Donald Faison says in this movie is great. I think he's a very funny guy, and his explanation is great. And even just like the lead in where he's like, "Excuse me, Miss Dion." He says it in such like an odd, kind of annoyed way. I don't have enough. Like, there are not enough positive things in the world for me to say about Donald Faison. And when he's reacting to them trying to find the party, and the scene just ends with him going, "Oh!" And he's so exasperated. I love it. He's the best.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah. And when he, just the face he makes and then walks away when he talks that thing about street slang and how it's mocking but not always misogynistic.
Yeah, it's so good.
Yeah, that's it. This is another one of the things I really like about this movie is that say what you want about the intelligence of the characters, but they're all very articulate and have a very which makes so many of those lines like I think 3.5 times funnier just because of how they're delivered.
Exactly. Like for a teen movie to be good, they kind of you kind of have to aim at the target audience of teens, but you have to be able to make it for people like us now, not us 20 years ago, able to enjoy it, right? Otherwise, you're really limiting your audience and limiting the word of mouth, because by making teens seem cool or seem smarter than they actually are, it makes teens happy, and it makes us okay with watching this movie about people that are much younger than us, and it can still be entertaining. Like something everybody in teen movies always kind of talks like a version of Aaron Sorkin in Training, and I feel like that's kind of very important to the teen movie aesthetic, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. Did you get a 10 Things I Hate About You vibe from this?
Well, 10 Things I Hate About You exists because of Clueless's success. Like, Clueless repurposing the old story and making it a teen movie really kind of kickstarts the whole, can we turn this Shakespeare play into a teen movie sort of thing that 10 Things I Hate About You, I think, is the figurehead for. You know? So, yes. Yes, I did.
But, like, just, as you said, kind of the classic literature and the matchmaking and everyone sounding smarter than they probably should be at that age.
Great cast. Do you think this? Cast.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Tons of people who we want to see in more things.
Yeah.
Do you think that this movie is going like has a bigger impact than Mean Girls?
I think this movie had, has and had, both short-term and long-term, a broader, impact on culture, particularly in the short-term, particularly in the mid-90s, because, it is my understanding that this movie was very influential fashion-wise and, brought back sort of the quote-unquote Valley speak. But I think Mean Girls is more a part of culture today than Clueless in obvious ways. You know, like the White House is tweeting on Mean Girls Day, or saying that Rufus should stop trying to bring Fetch back, whatever the Obama's dog's name is.
yeah, yeah.
So that, and they're not tweeting about the anniversary of Clueless, you know? So like today, and in obvious ways, Mean Girls' impact is more felt on a day-to-day basis, but Clueless is still very much a part of the culture we live in today, if only because of the influence it has had over the years and the people it has somehow inspired to write as if exclamation mark in whiteout on Canada Post mailboxes, you know? So I mean, that's kind of...
don't think that...
I'm kind of hedging my bets there, but I think the answer is kind of both in different ways.
I don't think that kind of what you're describing with, you know, like the White House getting on it and its presence in social media. Do you not think that just has more to do with timing and when this movie came out in a technology cycle?
I do 100% do. But that's the way it went, you know?
Right. Yeah, I guess like I hear people's like those quotes and things like that from Mean Girls. Yeah. You know, you hear it from friends, you hear it just from strangers, you hear it from, you know, the White House Twitter feed. But I feel like those are more quotes. Like, I feel like those are 10 phrases that matter. Whereas I think that people speak in a way that Clueless has taught them to speak without even being conscious of it. And I think it's more pervasive. And I think that the fashion and linguistic choices and like the sociolect of the Valley Girl, the California thing is so huge now. And I think this movie plays a big part of it. I think that this movie has a much, I would argue that Clueless has a bigger impact that just can't be traced back to it as easily. Whereas Mean Girls has a smaller impact where you can tell someone a timestamp of this movie and be like, look, Barack Obama said this, and that's what part of this movie's from. And I just don't think it's going to have its impact felt in 20 years from release date as much as Clueless has proven to.
No, exactly. And you kind of articulated what I was trying to say in a much, much better way. But yes, I agree entirely. And yeah, I mean, what can't be understated is how much just in general the internet loves Mean Girls, and that allows Mean Girls' popularity to yeah. continue well, to exist, you know, and to remain pervasive. And it just, yeah, it's exactly what you're saying. People quote it constantly because people know that people get that yeah. quote.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that young, you know, teenage girls with disposable income are early adopters of technology, especially of social media and things like that. And young females have a remarkable impact on the way people speak in larger culture. I think the word like is a good argument for that. I think that that's largely where that began. And now you're seeing people who never grew up with that word using it frequently as mm-hmm. like a hedge or just something to say. And yeah, I think, you know, you said 10 things I hate about you and I mean girls, I think owe a lot to Clueless. And I think it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, how many people, how many filmmakers, how many writers, how many things like that in the future point to Mean Girls as an influence versus who point to Clueless as an influence. And I think that because Mean Girls is, as you said, like more present in a way that you can trace back to it. You know, like I think that, as I said, Clueless is kind of still reverberating through culture in the way people speak and dress to a lesser extent, but still speak. But I think anyone born today loses the fact that maybe that's Clueless was the source of that. But I think because it's so verbatim, and I think Mean Girls says more stuff. I think Mean Girls is more preachy. I think that there is more conflict and that there is more about how people get along in Mean Girls. Like, I think Mean Girls has much more to say than Clueless does, even though I think Clueless has plenty to say as well. I think that Mean Girls is just kind of more didactic in that way, that there's certain lessons to be taken from it. And by the same token, there are certain lines to be taken from it. So I think it will kind of inspires the way people speak in a very direct way, kind of word for word quoting. And I think will probably inspire the way people make movies and media in the future because of, you know, what it said about high school friendships and about female relationships and what it says, what it's like to be in high school and sexuality and being exclusive in high school and things like that. I'll be very interested to see. And I think that they're going to have their presence felt decades down the road in different fashions.
Yeah, I agree. So I suppose we could just leave with this idea. What if Tina Fey wrote Punch Up on Mean Girls? Or sorry, on Clueless. How much better is Clueless? And how much more wonderful is an already wonderful movie? How much
more? Do you want to answer that or just leaving on that?
No, we're just leaving on that. So thank you. Thank you for listening to The MacGuffin. Be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. Follow us on Twitter at The MacGuffin. And yeah, we'll talk to you in the next episode.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.